You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Americans who are still looking for something to blame for Al Gore's loss to George W. Bush in the presidential election of 2000 may now have a target that they hadn't previously considered, the Chevrolet Corvair. At least that's the contention of Paul Ingrassia, author of Engines of Change, A History of the American Dream in 15 Cars. According to Mr. Ingrassia, it was the Corvair, with its tendency to lose traction on curves, that first put consumer advocate Ralph Nader on the national stage, and it was Mr. Nader who won the 95,000 votes in Florida that cost Al Gore a decisive victory. Paul Ingrassia's book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hello.
Well, thank you, Lenny. Great to be back.
Now, I'm sure that you've gotten complaints from car enthusiasts for not choosing their favorites. What criteria did you use to select these 15 cars, and why 15, not 20 or a dozen, for that matter?
It's a good question, both good questions. I actually started out with 10, then I realized there were some important trends in American society that I was really leaving out if I just had 10 cars. And even the 10 was a little bit fudged because I counted the Beetle and the Microbus from Volkswagen as one car, and that really they were two cars but part of the same chapter, if you will. But essentially, the criteria was simply I had to say, do we live or think differently as a people because those cars existed? So this is not about the best cars or the worst cars. It's about cars that shape the way we live and think, even to this day, or uniquely shaped the spirit and ethos of their era.
And I'm assuming you asked a lot of friends which cars they thought would be best. You say that you realized that a friend of yours had a deprived childhood when he suggested that you include the Dodge Dart, his high school car, in the 1970s.
That friend was actually, he's a friend and he's also my boss at Reuters, so I have to confess that the Dodge Dart wasn't going to make the list, I'm afraid.
So did a car have to have a commercial success to make the cut?
Well, no, not really. In fact, the Corvair arguably was certainly not a commercial success because it really only had about 4 to 5 years of decent sales before Ralph Nader's book came out. I mean, it was introduced in 1960. Ralph Nader's book, Unsafe at Any Speed, came out in 1965. So that was certainly not a commercial success. And if I had to do a 16th car, it might have been the Gremlin, the AMC Gremlin, which sort of symbolized the futility of the 70s as much as the Gremlin.
And then that we'd be reminded that Mitt Romney's father was the head of AMC.
Yes, he was a very successful. George Romney was a very successful head of AMC, the CEO during the 1950s when Rambler was at its peak. In fact, George Romney actually invented the term compact car.
Now, you've included the Pontiac GTO, although only 515,000 of them were sold during the 11 years they were made. Did it earn a place in your list because it was America's first muscle car?
Absolutely. I mean, it was America's first muscle car, introduced in 1964, really the same year as the Ford Mustang, by the way. But if you think of it, these two cars, Lenny, really, even though they came out in the same year, they symbolized and really captured the two different halves of the 1960s. You know, the first half of the 60s was kind of the good half of the decade. It was all about civil rights and Beatles and about the Ford Mustang. And then things took a little darker turn, and, you know, you had urban riots, you had the Rolling Stones, the Bad Boy Band, and you had the Bad Boy Car, which really was the Pontiac GTO.
And you had the Vietnam War, and then you had a bunch of assassinations.
Right. It was a bad time.
So the GTO represents assassinations?
I think that's a little bit of a stretch, but it did represent rebellion. I mean, in a way, it's ironic that the Volkswagen Beetle was a sort of a rebellious car, too, because it became the hippie car. But it was a different kind of rebellion. I mean, Beetle drivers and hippies wanted to raise people's consciousness. GTO drivers just kind of wanted to raise hell, if you will. So it was a different sort of rebellion.
Now, not all of the cars on your list have American roots, although foreign manufacturers, including Volkswagen and Honda, have produced cars in plants here in the United States. How many of your top 15 cars were made in the United States?
Well, basically almost all of them were made in the United States. The ones that were not were the Volkswagen Beetle and the Microbus and the BMW 3 Series and the Toyota Prius. So four of the 15 were not made in the United States. The other foreign nameplate car, the Honda Accord, was made both in the U.S. and in Japan. And frankly, the reason I included the Accord in the book was because it was the first foreign automobile to be made successfully in America. Production began in Ohio exactly 30 years ago this year.
And can we tell the difference between an Accord that was manufactured here and one that comes from Japan?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the ironies, when Honda first started building cars in America in 1982, American automobiles were in such ill repute that you had customers going into dealerships and saying, I want a Japanese-built Accord. And it was a couple years before people realized that, hey, the ones coming out of America are just as good as the ones built in Japan.
So why, when General Motors decided to build its own version of the Accord, the Saturn, did it turn out to not be anything half as good?
Well, first of all, the car's design wasn't really terrific. I mean, there was a lot of hype about Saturn revolutionizing the auto industry, and it was just basically, you know, a decent, good, but non-spectacular car.
But it was supposed to be the American Accord.
Right. But in many ways, it really wasn't as good. I mean, the gaps between the body panels, between the door and the fender, were about three times as wide as on the Accord. But frankly, what also happened, too, Saturn was set up, don't forget, as an experiment in ending the labor management strife that had plagued General Motors for most of its existence. And really what happened was it returned exactly to that strife. Basically, the UAW and GM management undermined their own creation for very different reasons.
My guest is Paul Ingracia, who has written a new book called Engines of Change, A History of the American Dream in 15 Cars. You won a Pulitzer for your coverage of General Motors while you were the Detroit bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal. And as you pointed out, you're now the deputy editor-in-chief of Reuters, which probably doesn't allow you to write as much about cars.
No, we have to worry about things, stories like Syria, the collapse of the euro. In fact, I'm actually flying to Athens this weekend to help be there when the Greek elections are, to work with our team on the ground there. But look, I mean, automobiles are an important global industry, and I certainly maintain an active role in working on our coverage on the auto industry.
And this is your third book about cars.
Yes.
So you obviously have your own love affair with cars.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it sort of grew slowly over many years, actually. But, you know, when I was assigned to based in Detroit for a decade, it's hard to get away from them. And just sort of the whole culture and ethos of the business was captivating, actually.
Now, Detroit is connected with the car business only in terms of the fact that it has this historical connection. How many cars are actually made in Detroit these days?
Well, I think hardly any at all. I mean, there is a factory. There's a factory in Hamtramck, which is completely surrounded by Detroit. So it really is, it sits right on the Detroit-Hamtramck city line, if you will, that General Motors operates. But that's about the only operating factory that is the only operating factory that GM has. And the other one is the Jeep Grand Cherokee that Chrysler builds in the city of Detroit on the Jefferson Avenue plant.
You've only included two cars on your list that were made before World War II, the Model T Ford, obvious, and the other one, the General Motors LaSalle.
Right, the GM LaSalle, which was a companion brand to Cadillac. The reasoning for that was really pretty simple. I mean, if you step back and let's forget about cars for a minute and let's just think about culture. American culture is this yin-yang between and tug-of-war between the practical and the pretentious, the ordinary and the ostentatious. The Model T was very practical. I mean, it would flex with the roads. It was the first people's car. Henry Ford's favorite joke was about the farmer that wanted to be buried in his Model T because the car had gotten him out of every hole he'd ever been in. And it was the best-selling car in the world for 20 years. But then America in the 20s became more prosperous, more urban. People wanted cars for social mobility as well as for physical mobility. Along comes a very stylish car, the LaSalle, the first mass-market designer car, the first car by Harley Earl, who was the father of automotive design. And that was introduced in 1927, the very year that the Model T went out of production. If you remember the old All in the Family sitcom from the 70s, the introductory song that Archie and Edith sang, mm-hmm. The fourth line was, "Gee, our old LaSalle ran great." That's what they were referring to, even though the car had died in 1940.
So LaSalle predated the Cadillac and the Packard as the prestige car?
Well, it was a direct competitor to the Packard. Actually, Cadillacs were too big and too costly to compete against the Packard. So General Motors introduced a junior Cadillac, the LaSalle, and that mortally wounded Packard, as a matter of fact.
The first post-war car you've included is the Corvette, which was introduced by Chevrolet in 1953. Hasn't the company been making some version of that car ever since?
Oh, it's been making an evolutionary progressive version of the car ever since. In fact, if you look at the Corvette's horsepower over the years, it's sort of like the length of, you know, women's hemlines, basically. I mean, that sort of indicates whether the country's doing well or not. Back in the 1970s, the Corvette got down to 165 horsepower. Now you can get a 600 horsepower Corvette. But 1953 was a seminal
600
year.
600 power? 600 horsepower? What do you need 600 horsepower for?
Unless you don't need it.
Entering the Indy 500.
Right. It's not that you need it. It's that you want it. I mean, remember the practical and the pretentious? Okay. This is a little pretentious, shall we say.
The Corvette Stingray from the early to mid-60s is the most popular collector car version of the Corvette. And I'm told that one in perfect condition from 1967 might fetch $200,000 at an auction.
Oh, at least $200,000 at an auction.
Why? I mean, people want to drive that or just stick it in a showcase?
Well, both, actually. I mean, they would probably drive a car like that fairly sparingly, but the 63 Corvette Stingray with the split window, which was only made for 1 year, there was a big dispute between the GM design staff and the engineering staff over the split, the bar that went down the middle of the window. So it was only made for 1 year. It's like a flawed penny. That's what makes it so collectible.
And what made the Corvette so popular?
Well, 1953 was a seminal year in America. It was the year that the Korean War ended, the year that Elvis started recording music, and the year that Hugh Hefner started a magazine called Playboy. So you get this picture of a generation of Americans that had grown up knowing 25 years of depression and then war. People wanted to let loose a little bit, and along comes the Corvette. Remarkably, it was a terrible car at first. GM was ready to kill it. And the car was only saved by the direct, passionate intervention of a Russian-Jewish immigrant engineer named Zora Arkasduntov, who pleaded with management, "Give me a chance to improve this car." And management relented. And, you know, this was the height of the Red Scare era. I think if Senator Joe McCarthy had known that a Bolshevik boy, Zora was raised in St. Petersburg before the Revolution. If Senator McCarthy had known that a Bolshevik boy had saved the Corvette, it might have become a commie plot.
Although what was good for General Motors was good for America at that point.
Exactly.
Another car on your list is the 59 Cadillac convertible with its huge tail fins. You've called these cars tail fin land yachts.
Well, exactly. I mean, tail fins were the, shall we say, Lenny, they were the epitome of America's post-war exuberance, if you will. I mean, the sky's the limit ethos of that time. We are the world. The 59 Cadillac tail fins were the biggest of all time.
And what was the reason the Cadillac put them on? They said that they were directional stabilizers.
Well, actually, that came from a competing tail fins like Chrysler. The line that Chrysler used on its 1957 tail fins was graceful directional stabilizers, basically claiming a safety benefit. These were a safety device.
They were just decorative, but what was the appeal?
Well, the appeal was showing off again. It was a stylistic thing. The history of tail fins, well, they started actually in 1948 with little finlets, if you were, on the back of Cadillacs. That continued for a few years, and then Chrysler started putting bigger fins on its cars in 1955, and suddenly its market share and profits jumped. And that created the great tail fin war between Chrysler and General Motors. And finally, in 59, General Motors said, enough, we're going to put those upstarts down. And they created the 59 Cadillac with the greatest fins ever seen on a vehicle that did not fly.
But we haven't seen Finns in a while.
So no, I don't think...
They just lost their appeal at a certain point?
Yeah, they disappeared in 1965. And look, we're not going to see them again. They add a lot of weight to a car, and they don't really serve any functional purpose.
But there are all sorts of things that don't serve functional purposes. On the backs of cars today, you see this little, I forgot what it's called, but like a little hood over the rear window. And they have no purpose other than the fact that I'm told they appeal to men.
It's called spoilers.
Right.
Right. And the answer, and they're often on the rear trunk as well as the window sometimes. But the answer is, there are certain limits you can accept within fuel economy limits and weight regulations and that sort of thing with the weight dimensions. Tail fins are just a little over the top, shall we say.
Paul Ingrassia is formerly the Detroit bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal, later the president of Dow Jones Newswires, now deputy editor-in-chief at Reuters. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1993 with Joseph B. White for reporting on management crises at General Motors. And he's the author of a number of books on the auto industry, the most recent, Engines of Change, A History of the American Dream in 15 Cars. It is published by Simon & Schuster. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Ingrassia. His latest book, Engines of Change, A History of the American Dream in 15 Cars, published by Simon & Schuster. And you didn't say American cars because you've included two cars from the German-based car maker Volkswagen, the Beetle and the VW Microbus. The Beetle was distinguished in part by a rear-mounted air-cooled engine. Was the engine for the Microbus also in the rear?
Well, it was in the middle of the Microbus there because the engine the vehicle was longer, but it was the same exact really chassis and design, just a different body on the Microbus.
The name Volkswagen means people's car, and it was developed in the 30s at the request of Adolf Hitler, wasn't it?
Well, exactly. Ferdinand Porsche created it, but it was created at the behest of Hitler, who wanted to replicate what Henry Ford had done in creating a people's car for the German people. The exact name of the Beetle initially was not Volkswagen or Beetle. It was the Kraft-Durch-Freude-Wagen, which meant the strength through joy car. It was a name decreed by the Führer himself.
Strength through joy. I couldn't imagine saying that every time I got into my strength through joy car.
Well, exactly. Actually, it was shortened to the KDF car because everybody hated the name, but nobody wanted to argue with the Führer.
But they didn't like the Beetle either later.
The Germans actually did not like the word Beetle. They wouldn't allow it to be used until the early 70s.
Didn't Hitler even send a delegation to Michigan to get advice on car production from Henry Ford? Now, Ford was something of an admirer of Hitler, at least at first.
At first he was, and of course Henry Ford, frankly, was a notorious anti-Semite. But it's true that Henry Ford did receive a delegation from Germany about advice on how to build the car. And a few German emigres who had left Germany and worked in the Ford Motor factories in Detroit and in the engineering shops actually went back to Germany to work on the car. It was not the best career move, as things turned out.
But Ferdinand Porsche, you say, actually designed it. Was he already making his famous sports cars?
No, those came. He was doing that simultaneously. But those came into full flower after the war. Although yes, he was a legend in German racing circles. At the same time, he was doing the Beetle.
Is it ironic that the Volkswagen became so popular with American hippies in the 60s, and that Doyle Dane Birnbeck, one of the first ad agencies to have major Jewish members of at the top of the staff, made the car so popular?
It's incredible that you couldn't make it up. Let's put it this way: from Hitler's car to hippie icon, one of the Doyle Dane senior people said, we have to sell a Nazi car in a Jewish town. But it really caught on because in the wake of the tail fin era, it was this yin yang between the pretentious and the practical. So you had the pretentious Cadillac with the tail fins. Driving a Beetle was a way to make a different statement about yourself.
And we've seen that yin-yang going on up until today, although now the Cadillac would be the SUV, and that's kind of waning in popularity for the moment. Smaller cars are popular, but that's largely because gas is around $4 a gallon. In the day that the Beetle came along, gas was 27 cents a gallon.
Right. Well, when everything was relative, of course, everything was cheaper back then. But this same tug of war between the practical and the pretentious, the ordinary and the ostentatious, does indeed continue. And the SUV really, in a sense, became the tail fins of our time.
It's interesting that Volkswagen would go along with the Doyle Dane campaign, Think Small. That was really innovative. It wasn't it kind of like a breakthrough in advertising that then led to so many other incredible ads like the Alka-Seltzer ads?
Well, yeah, it was actually it was innovative. It might even be called subversive in a way. I mean, one of my favorite Volkswagen ads from that era showed a Beetle parked out in front of a suburban prosperous house on a suburban street that said, "What year car do the Joneses drive?" Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you couldn't tell because they looked the same every year. Meanwhile, the whole American economy, driven by Detroit in those days, is built on the annual model change and keeping up with the Joneses. Another ad, this whole self-deprecating humor showed Wilt Chamberlain, a 7-foot-1-inch African-American basketball player, at a time when few African-Americans were featured in advertising, trying to climb into a Beetle, and the headline was, "They said it couldn't be done." It couldn't.
Well, now we have this ad with Shaquille O'Neal climbing into a small car and saying, "I have plenty of space."
Exactly. And even the point of the Wilt Chamberlain ad was, gee, if you're 7-foot-1, it's probably not going to work for you. But if you're 6-foot-7 or shorter, you can get into the Beetle no problem.
There was a spoof of the VW ad in the National Lampoon that kind of hurt sales.
Yeah, it did for a while. Actually, this was Volkswagen had an ad in the 60s. Showing how basically it had a watertight body, and the headline was, "It floats." Well, in the early 70s, after the Chappaquiddick incident with Ted Kennedy, National Lampoon ran a spoof ad saying, "If Ted Kennedy was driving a Volkswagen, he'd be president today." Well, people thought it was a real ad and responded with outrage, and as a result, National Lampoon actually had to recall all of its magazines.
VW's success with its rear-mounted air-cooled engine inspired Chevrolet to do their own a car in 1959 with a similar engine design.
The Corvair. Absolutely. It was a creation of Ed Cole, a true engineering genius, introduced in 1960. And if you go back and read the ads that General Motors took out for the Corvair when it was introduced, they could almost read like Prius ads today. It said, "Our streets are more and more crowded. You can't find a place to park. Gas prices are soaring. People are driving further and further to work." So the Corvair actually was ahead of its time. It got 29 miles to the gallon. Other cars got less than half that.
What was the VW getting?
The VW was definitely in that range, but that was a much smaller car. I mean, you could only fit 4, maybe 5 people at the most in a Beetle. The Corvair would hold 6.
And Motor Trend named it its car of the year.
In 1964, absolutely.
But then a writer for the Saturday Evening Post was the first to point out that having so much weight in the back of the car made it prone to spinning out on curves, similar to the way that a skater did at the end of a crack of the whip line.
Crack the whip line. That's a very vivid imagery. And that article was written when the Corvair was first introduced. But it was really not till 5 years later that Ralph Nader's book, Unsafe at Any Speed, described the string of accidents that had been attributed to the Corvair. Ironically, the book was a flop at first, and what made the book a bestseller was the national publicity that happened when it was revealed in the New York Times that General Motors had hired private detectives to spy on Nader's life. So what happened then was there were hearings in front of Congress, and the president of General Motors, Jim Roach, came down and apologized publicly to Nader. Nader actually missed the apology, Lenny, because he didn't own a car and couldn't get a cab that morning. You couldn't make it up.
Now, you contend that that book, Unsafe at Any Speed, not only doomed the Corvair's future, but also launched the entire field of liability law.
Well, exactly right. I mean, basically, product liability law in America took off as a growth industry only after the Corvair was introduced. Basically, product liability law was redefined. It was easier to prove a product defect. And this trend continued even to this day, but it reached its epitome in the 1994 or 5 McDonald's hot coffee case. All the legal precedents there were set by the Chevy Corvair.
My guest is Paul Ingrassia. His latest book, Engines of Change, A History of the American Dream in 15 Cars, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another car on your list is the Ford Mustang, developed by Lee Iacocca.
Right, exactly.
In 1964, wasn't the Mustang's design based on the design of an earlier car, the Ford Falcon, which had been a no-frills car?
Well, exactly. That's the irony of it. The Mustang was basically a sexy body, a wonderfully styled vehicle on the chassis of the boring old Ford Falcon. In fact, one Ford executive told the Detroit Free Press that, you know, we had turned a librarian into a sex pot, words that executives really don't use in describing their cars today or much of anything else. But another imagery that one of Iacocca's associates used was it was kind of like putting falsies on grandma.
Then you've also included, I'm not going to pursue that, Pontiac's GTO on your list. Was the GTO the first car to be called a muscle car?
It was, and basically it was a monstrous engine put in the body of a very small car for its time, the Pontiac Tempest.
And it reminds us that John DeLorean was in the auto business.
Well, John DeLorean was the father, really the father of the GTO. It was basically his car, and it reflected his rebel personality. General Motors had regulations that basically said you could not put a big engine in a small car, internal regulations. But DeLorean found a way to skirt the rules. He basically realized that the rules only applied to new models. And initially, the GTO was an optional equipment package on the old Pontiac Tempest. So it was the GTO option on the Tempest.
And it became a success,
relatively.
So did GM change its rules?
It ignored the rules, basically. It just sort of let them go. I mean, it sold far more than people imagined, and it was very little development cost, too. You could make great profits on that car because there was really very little new engineering involved.
What about the DeLorean itself? Was that a good car?
No, it wasn't. It was a terrible car.
So how could this man who had run the Pontiac division successfully come up with a car that whose only claim to fame is that it's in Back to the Future?
Well, you know, he had a great reputation. He could raise money. He sort of beguiled the British government to letting him build a factory in Belfast. But, you know, just think about this. The factory's in Belfast. The headquarters is in New York. The sales office is in Los Angeles. The engine's built in France. The engineering work is done in London. I mean, none of this stuff was coordinated back in those days. It fit DeLorean's jet-setting lifestyle, but the quality of the car was atrocious.
How important were the rock records by the Beach Boys, Wilson Pickett, and others, especially the country singers? How much of a role did they play in popularizing these cars?
Well, a huge role, actually. I mean, the song by Ronnie and the Daytonas, Little GTO, actually the title is just GTO, but was really a great song in 1964 that helped propel the car to success. The chapter I wrote on pickup trucks really gave me I had a lot of fun with that chapter because I got to write about the simultaneous mainstreaming, if you will, of country music and pickup trucks, which began in the 1970s. They were both fringe sort of products, really, in society. But then the 70s came, and we had the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour. We had the Johnny Cash Show. And I got to write about a couple of my favorite country songs by Joe Diffie. One is Pickup Man. And the other is Leroy the Redneck Reindeer, about a pickup driving reindeer.
the battle between the practical and the ostentatious continues. You compare the Honda Accord and the Chrysler minivan, both considered relatively practical,
absolutely,
with the BMW 3 Series.
Well, that was the official yuppie car, if you will, the unofficial yuppie car of the 1980s. If you remember, back in that day, there was all this alphabet soup sociology going around. Yuppie stood for young urban professionals. Then there were dinks, double income, no kids. Then there were orchids, one recent child hideously in debt, and so on. But yuppies really flocked to the BMW. They were actually another way of showing off, like the tail fins, but it was functional luxury, not pretentious luxury.
But then you have another kind of showing off, the Jeep, the Hummer.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, Jeeps basically, again, were a very marginal item in the American auto industry until the late 70s when Chrysler under Iacocca bought control of Jeep from the French owners. And essentially, they really took Jeep and mainstreamed Jeep just the same way that L.L. Bean was mainstreaming its backpacks and Patagonia made all this outdoor gear, but they colored it in peach and mango and teal, and people started buying it just for everyday wear.
Although driving on the highway and seeing a Jeep or a Hummer, I felt like I was going off to war, or somebody was going off to war. But then there were the SUVs, which kind of just muscled all the other cars off the road.
Well, SUVs became a huge trend because they became a, you know, it was all about the wilderness chic thing in the 1990s. People wanted to project an active, healthy outdoor lifestyle. And along comes the Jeep, and it's the perfect thing to wear with to drive when you're wearing your L.L. Bean plaid shirt, even if you're just going to the mall.
You've included Ford's F-Series pickup trucks on the list. I didn't realize that they are America's best-selling vehicle, have been for the past 33 years.
Right, the best-selling vehicle of overall. Now there's, you know, the best-selling car has been different, but the best-selling car and truck vehicle of any kind has been the F-Series for a long time, absolutely.
What does it do that makes it so popular?
Well, one of the things that makes it popular, it has dual use as a commercial vehicle, but there's also versions that are essentially recreational show-off vehicles for the suburban cowboy. I mean, you can get the King Ranch Edition, if you will. The seats have more leathers than most cows do. I mean, there's the Harley-Davidson edition for middle-aged guys that want to haul their Harley bikes to Harley conventions in their Harley truck. So Ford has been very creative in marketing these things.
The final car on your list is the Toyota Prius, although it's easy to poke fun at the Prius. Isn't it an impressive feat of engineering?
Incredible feat of engineering. I mean, the quest for a practical gas hybrid electric car actually goes back to the, you know, really more than 100 years. Ferdinand Porsche's, one of his first designs was a gas hybrid electric, but the modern electronic engine controls that made it go back and forth were not available really in the late 1890s. So it's a remarkable feat of engineering.
And it seems to still be doing better than some of the other hybrids.
Well,
why did Chevy have so much trouble coming up with its own version?
Well, I think part of the reason is that Chevy tried to leapfrog with the new technology in the Volt as opposed to doing, so it was really more of an electric vehicle with a little gas option on it. Not a gas option, a gas feature on it.
And you could plug it into your any outlet in your home.
Any outlet in your home, whereas the Prius is a lot more convenient in the sense that the battery recharges itself with kinetic energy and with the gasoline engine recharging the battery when it gets low.
In his review in the Daily News, one of the many enthusiastic reviews, I might add, of this book, Jacob Osterholt pointed out that although your book purports to be about cars, it's really about people, the engineers, businessmen, advertising executives who created and sold them.
Well, I think it is about people, and it's also about the people who bought them. It's about us. It's about us as Americans.
Will the smart car be on your next list?
Probably not. No, I think it's actually the car you're picking up today. I think a new Honda Fit will probably be a better buy for you than the smart car, more functional.
You said that the smart car isn't such a smart car.
No, it's not, because it's smaller than the Honda Fit, but the gas mileage isn't very good, so it's not as good gas mileage and less functional.
So is it just like the Cooper Mini, a car that people like because draws attention when you're driving it?
I think it does, but the Mini Cooper actually is far more stylish and more successful than the smart car.
Paul Ingrassia's latest book is Engines of Change, A History of the American Dream in 15 Cars. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Lenny.